everyone. This is an emergency broadcast. The unpleasant noise you are about to hear coming from your radio is not a mistake. Please do not turn off your radio, but turn up the volume on your receiver as high as it can go so that you can make the sound we broadcast as loud as possible.
So, what are the odds that the Queen comes back as a zombie and disrupts the coronation of King Charles III? I mean, you could just see the zombie Queen crashing into Westminster Abbey, tear the crown off of Charles's head and knock the orb out of his hand before she tries to tear his throat out with her bare dentures. Doubtless he'd be flailing around trying to beat her back to death with the sceptre, shouting to his security detail to shoot her in the head. Maybe the whole of the recently deceased royal family could crawl out of the tomb at Windsor in various states of decay and cause mayhem at the coronation. Prince Philip, who face it looked like the living dead in his last days, could lurch toward whoever's prime minister at the time, presumably Rishi Sunak, and arms outstretched like Bela Lugosi in Frankenstein meets the Wolfman, and try to tear the head off. Well, the Queen Mother could try to eat the Archbishop of Canterbury, so long as her jaw doesn't fall off mid-bite, that is. Doubtless it would transpire that they'd been resurrected by a royalist faction unhappy at Charles's too woke reign and his plans to slim down the royal family by dispensing with the hangers-on. See, this stuff just writes itself, doesn't it? Perhaps we need to get this going as a conspiracy theory, that the Queen will rise from the tomb at the coronation in order to save the monarchy. Well, it'd make a good movie, if nothing else. Surely somebody out there must be planning something like this for a director streaming release. Or are we past peak low-budget shot and mobile phone zombie movies? Even if we weren't, I'm not sure that anyone would have the nerve to try and make something like this. There's just too much deference to the monarchy about in the UK. Besides, you'd never get away with filming it in the UK. The tabloids would be all over it shouting, treason, etc. And the production inevitably shut down. It would have to be shot overseas in some unlikely location pretending to be London, preferably one that gives tax breaks to film productions. I mean, you'd be amazed how much like London Luxembourg looks. At least that's what the makers of some direct-to-video Jack Higgins adaptations tried to make us think back in the 90s. There was also, I vaguely recall, one of those cheesy Charles and Diana romance TV movies which tried to convince us that Luxembourg looked like central London, but there you go. Nowadays, they tend to prefer Hungary or Romania as locations for these sorts of things. Let's face it, for international audiences who've never been to the UK, as long as there are lots of old buildings about in a red double-decker bus driving past, then hell, it looks like London. Anyway, that's my latest low-budget movie idea. Zombie Queen, Queen Zombie, Queen of the Zombies, or whatever. I'm putting it out there for potential backers. Just the publicity it would generate by getting the right-wing press's piss boiling would surely guarantee a hit.
And out of their West Indian island comes a tale of terror and voodoo, of witchcraft and zombies, and all the weird black magic that the white man seldom sees. It is a tale of brother against brother and their love for a woman who lived with the dead. And it is also the tale of a young nurse who never believed such things could happen.
Are you trying to tell me that the voodoo priest could cure Mrs. Holland?
Better, Doc.
Dambala, this woman is ill.
This is the ceremony of voodoo death, a ceremony that seeks the life of the woman who lives forever, who walks with the dead.
I have to say, I got tired, as we're talking of the late Queen Elizabeth II, I got pretty tired of the Queen Elizabeth II death cult very quickly, because that's what it felt like, with endless reports on TV and in the papers of exactly where a coffin was at any given time, not to mention who was standing by it, following it, or I don't know, polishing it. Not to mention all those people who queued to walk past it, first in Edinburgh and then later in London. Do you know, people spent all night on the pavement in London to try and make sure that they were at the front of the queue. So I don't know about anyone else, but I found it all rather creepy and morbid. And then there was the obsession with the details of the funeral itself. With all the adulation of the late queen going on in the media, I was half expecting to hear that, like an ancient Egyptian pharaoh, she was going to be interred in a gold sarcophagus in a huge pyramid built on the south bank by slave labour. Well, universal credit claimants. Much the same thing. Of course, they'd all be slaughtered along with the servants and corgis, and possibly her favourite horses, in order to keep her company through all eternity. And maybe they were going to wall up one of the royal Daimlers in there as well. Its mummified chauffeur behind the wheel so that she'd go for a spin in the afterlife. But there you go. So, you know, obviously, you've guessed I wasn't one of those people watching the royal funeral. I mean, I'd like to say that I spent the day watching videos and asties instead of a funeral. Because, you know, it's what she would have wanted. But I actually ended up going to the beach. I'd hoped that traffic would be light, but it seemed that a significant proportion of the supposedly grieving nation, as the media would have you believe, had the same idea. But hey, it was still a lot more enjoyable than watching someone else's funeral. I mean, I did have a contingency plan if the weather hadn't been good, which involved a streaming channel I recently found, which had some pretty recent movies available without subscription. I'm assuming that none of them are legal, but I don't know about anyone else. But I'm afraid that my morals with regard to copyright violations have become very slack of late, particularly with regard to huge multinational corporations with turnovers in the billions. To be honest, my lack of conscience over this sort of thing is probably in the blood. I watched enough pirate videos back in the good old days of VHS. As part of my cinematic education, back then there was no other way to see these movies. It undoubtedly helped that my father worked at Radio Rentals, so I got to see dupes of the various movies they were renting with their VHS players. Not only that, but also all manner of other weird and wonderful stuff that had somehow acquired by staff and consequently copied multiple times and widely shared. Anyway, it was in this spirit that I watched a number of films from another streaming channel whose library's legal status I'm highly suspicious of. Although their films are all of older vintage, mainly from the 50s, 60s, 70s and 80s. I kicked all off by revisiting the original 1958 version of The Fly. Shot in colour and CinemaScope, The Fly looks like an A feature, but plot-wise plays out like the B movie it really is. It's a curious film, which certainly delivers its big shock revelation of David Hedison's fly head and arm, but its flashback structure robs it of impetus and suspense. We know how it ends from the opening, meaning that we know the search for the fly with Hedison's head and arm will prove futile. It finally topples over into sheer lunacy, not to mention hilarity, with the human-headed fly finally found trapped in a spider's web pleading, "Help me! Help me!" in a shrill voice to Vincent Price and Herbert Marshall. Not surprisingly, neither actor could keep a straight face. Overall, though, it remains a tremendously enjoyable piece of schlock. Its two sequels, by contrast to the original, were most definitely B-movies shot in black and white. Return of the Fly, from 1959, did little other than repeat the plotline of the original, but on a lower budget. It did retain Vincent Price and featured a superior makeup for the titular creature, but it's far less innovative. The second sequel, Curse of the Fly, made in 1965, is somewhat more inventive, ditching human-fly hybrids and focusing instead on exploring the possibilities of the matter transmission plot device of the earlier films. Shot in the UK but still pretending to be set in Canada, it has Brian Donlevy rather than Vincent Price as its imported US star. And there's a number of co-productions Robert Lippert developed with British producer Jack Parsons. Despite a low budget, it's a far more satisfying film than the first sequel.
Will everyone in the theatre hold on firmly to his seat, please? I'm Vincent Price. What unearthly horror did that girl gaze upon? What manner of incredible thing walked beneath that hood? It would be unfair at this time to show you any more of what went on in that laboratory where a man actually dared to play God. So fantastic, words can't begin to describe it. You must see it with your own eyes to believe it. When the fly comes your way.
It isn't like any other fly I've ever seen.
Leave it alone! No! No! Please let me look at the fly! I've killed Andre. Please help me. Call the police and...
The charge can only be murder.
There were no mistresses. I had no lovers.
Why did you kill him?
God, don't let it get out.
Inspector. Inspector, it's in the garden. Come quickly.
As God is my witness, I saw the thing. It's unbelievable. I shall never forget that scream as long as I live.
The fly is on its way. Watch out for it. It's far beyond anything your mind could ever conceive.
You know, I've been having another of those viewing experiences where every time I tune into a particular Roku channel, the same bloody film is showing, albeit at a different point each time. The channel in question is American Horrors Classic, the other American Horrors channel, recently set up by Hart D. Fisher to extend his brand. You'd hope that with double the number of channels, you'd now have double the selection of films, but it seems that the same number of movies are now simply being spread over two channels. That said, I don't recall having seen this particular film, Honeymoon Horror, from 1982, having ever shown up on the original channel. Even when seen in brief segments while channel hopping and out of order, it has to be said that Honeymoon Horror is a truly dreadful film. It's another example of low-budget regional filmmaking by a bunch of local filmmakers, in this case in Texas. Featuring a no-name cast of non-actors, presumably friends of the producers, it is a truly generic slasher movie. It has all the tropes present. A remote location, in this case an island, housing a hotel, specialising in honeymooners. The usual group of victims, honeymooners, some random co-ed girls. Dark secrets, an obvious red herring suspect, axe murders and a killer who turns out to be that guy who supposedly burned to death in the prologue. Oh, not to forget the bumbling local law enforcement. Actually, the scenes with the sheriff and his deputies were added later, presumably to bring the running time up to feature length. It seemed to be intended as comic relief. Relief from what? I'm not sure. Certainly not the gore and horror, which are pretty mild, nor the suspense, which is pretty much non-existent. Characters just seem to stand around waiting to be murdered. Perhaps they're there to distract from the script and acting, although these added scenes feature equally inane dialogue and hammy performances. The worst performance, though, in the entire film is the English maid, who talks as if she just wandered in from a Basil Rathbone Sherlock Holmes film. "Lawks a mercy, fair gives me the willies it does," she utters, or words to that effect. And it is worth noting that the film has a contemporary US setting rather than Victorian Whitechapel. It's a relief when she's the first character to fall victim to the killer. Truly, this film is an endurance test, regardless of how you watch it. In short segments as I did, or in one go straight through, which I wouldn't recommend. Yet it does occupy a significant place in horror film history, in that it was one of the first movies to be picked up by a major distributor for a direct-to-video release. Sony bought it and released it on VHS in 1982, subsequently making a significant profit from rentals. The fact that Honeymoon Horror was only ever released on VHS for rental and never on DVD reinforces my suspicion that much of the film content on both American Horror's channels consists of Hart D. Fisher's personal VHS collection, which itself consists of second or third generation VHS dupes. So crappy are their quality. If that sounds like a rebuke or criticism, it really isn't. As I've noted before, the only way to watch these films is in this condition. It's part of their charm, and I remain a fan of Fisher's Roku channels for providing this authentic retro viewing experience. Even something as awful as Honeymoon Horror has a certain mesmeric hold upon me thanks to its sheer VHS-era crappiness. The low-budget stuff turned out these days just looks too slick to be truly entertaining the same way, and worse, is far too self-conscious of its crappiness.
You get away from me, you dirty old man! This place fair gives me the willies. I'll be glad to get home tonight.
That goddamn boot. Now you just get off my case here. Now you make a left turn up here at this corner right here, and we're going to get on out there.
Yes, sir.
You know how to get out there, don't you?
Yes, sir.
We're going to head up to the dock, and I'm going to drive the boat.
Sure is a beautiful morning, ain't it?
We ain't out here to enjoy the weather, Junior.
Yes, sir.
You know, I've never had such a case of phonitis in all my born days.
Phonitis, sir?
You know what I mean. I've had enough phone calls in the last few days about that damn island to last me a lifetime.
Exciting, isn't it?
Exciting? I tell you, Junior, I don't understand these folks. They spend all their money sending these kids off to school to have a good time, and all they do is sit home and worry and worry and worry.
I don't know what makes them worry. I keep wondering about that.
Well, stop your wondering and keep this son of a bitch moving.
Yes, sir.
Can't you make this move any faster?
I have it full out now, Homer.
Cut this Homer crap. It's cheap to you while we're on the case.
Bullshit. There's only two of us on this boat, sir.
And when we get on the island, you make sure your language is clean for all these kids. You hear?
Yes, sir. Over and out.
Then save the over and out for the intercom. You hear?
Yes, sir.
Phone calls.
Sheriff, everybody's dead. I mean, the Carlins are dead, and the girls from the sorority, and Sue and Linda.
Well, who's left?
Well, there's me and Kay, and Joe's tied up in his place. Well, my two buddies, they swam to the mainland. Didn't they get hold of you?
No, we didn't hear from them.
Oh, my God.
Well, where's your wife?
She's over on the beach.
Well, you get over there and get her on the boat. We're going to go up and find out what the hell's going on. Now, come on now, Jerry.
I knew these kids running around here all night, someone's able to get killed.
If something is around long enough, or becomes popular enough, then it will inevitably spawn a porn or sex comedy cash-in. So it's somewhat surprising that the BBC's venerable science fiction series Doctor Who didn't get one until 2005's Abducted by the Daleks, clearly made to exploit the series' revival that year. Perhaps there had been previous cash-ins. I can't say that I keep up with such things, although I fondly remember Katie Manning's nude photo shoot with the Dalek for Men's Magazine while she's still a regular in the series back in the 70s. But if there were, they didn't create the furore that Abducted by the Daleks made at the time. Indeed, the level of outrage in some circles created by the film seems hardly justified by what, in reality, is a crudely made skin flick, apparently made on a budget only slightly less than that of its progenitor. But, of course, that's the point of this type of exploitation. The free publicity that can be generated by riding the coattails of a legit property to drive the sales of a shoddy product that would otherwise slip by unnoticed. The thing about Abducted by the Daleks, though, is that not only is it the most basic of parodies of its source, but it doesn't even work as porn. The sex is minimal, confined to a couple of perfunctory lesbian encounters, with the film instead presenting a parade of bare female flesh as its main titillation. Most disappointingly, they don't even exploit the pornographic potential of the Daleks to the full. I mean, they look like a bunch of huge knobbly self-propelled dildos, for God's sake. We don't even get any sucker groping from their appendages, nor any bottom pinching from the one with a pincer rather than a sucker. Not to mention the fact that their ray guns bear a certain resemblance to a vibrator, but this is never exploited in the film. Of course, Abducted by the Daleks is part of a long tradition of taking something relatively innocuous and innocent and sexing it up to produce something aimed fairly and squarely at an adult audience. It lies in the same continuum as all those porno versions of children's fairy tales or adaptations of children's novels, Alice in Wonderland being, as I recall, a popular subject for porn adaptations. Ultimately, I suppose, it's a variation on the male fantasy of deflowering innocent young virgins by corrupting them with sensuality. Abducted by the Daleks is an interesting case, though, as its source material is itself not entirely innocent and has arguably been itself guilty of playing on male fantasies, with its succession of increasingly sexually attractive young female assistants, who are not infrequently to be seen in various states of undress, who are clearly there to attract the older male viewer. At the same time, the casting of younger actors in the title role would seem to be aimed at attracting the older female audience. Indeed, Doctor Who does seem to have stirred various erotic fantasies among fans long before Abduction of the Daleks, if we're to believe Tom Baker's autobiography, that is, where he recalls an encounter with a female groupie in a hotel room who leapt on him demanding, "Take me through time, Doctor." Actually, I think that would have been funnier if she'd lunged his genitals with an egg whisk in one hand, a sink plunger in the other, shouting, "Fornicate!" Sadly, though, Abduction of the Daleks never really builds on any of these underlying sexual currents in the source material, instead seeming to feel that the mere presence of the titular monsters is sufficient exploitation in itself, which is surprising, as the makers do appear to have more than a passing familiarity with Doctor Who, with the Daleks apparently modelled on those seen in the 60s Amicus film adaptations in terms of their colour schemes. There's a red one, a silver one, and a gold one. Or is it black? Anyway. And also in terms of their equipment. As I noted before, one of them, like some of the film Daleks, has a pincer instead of a sucker. Moreover, the various crew members who work in the film are billed under names like Billy Hartnell, Patrick Baker, and, of course, the director, Dan Scaro. Nonetheless, it makes no real attempt to parody the source series plot-wise, design-wise, well, apart from the Daleks, or character-wise. Doubtless they felt they were infringing copyright enough by using the Dalek design and name. The plot and its execution are, even by porn parody standards, pretty idiotic. Four girls are driving through some woods at night when they hit something on the road, an alien as it turns out, and naturally investigate by wandering around the woods, which have already been established as the haunt of a murderer of young women known as the Serial Skinner. For some reason, one of them gets separated from her friends and for no good reason takes her clothes off, at which point she is transported aboard the Dalek spaceship to be examined as a specimen of humanity in order to help their invasion plans. Pretty soon, the other two follow suit, stripping off and being abducted, while the fourth turns out to be a Dalek agent and is beamed aboard to help torture the others. Much mayhem ensues before the fourth girl escapes back to the woods and survives encounters with an alien hunter and the Serial Skinner, who turns out to be an alien, before a twist ending. Production values are crude in the extreme. The interior of the Dalek ship has walls and doors that wobble dangerously. Well, in the final scene, the police station interior consists of a desk with a flashing blue light on it. The acting is universally awful, especially the four girls, who I strongly suspect weren't cast on the basis of acting ability. All have very strong Eastern European accents, which unfortunately mask much of their dialogue, although, to be fair, I'm sure it wasn't worth hearing in the first place, and understanding it really isn't necessary to following the plot such as it is. Actually, you know, no. On further consideration, I think that the guy playing the policeman in the last scene is the worst actor in the film. He isn't from Eastern Europe, so we can clearly hear every word of his poorly delivered, idiotic dialogue. There's one interesting casting development in the film, though. When she teleports back to Earth, the fourth girl is suddenly played by a different actress. This change in appearance is addressed in the film, with a girl speculating that a fault with the matter transmitter could have changed the DNA. Now, there's been much discussion online as to why this change of actress mid-film took place, with speculation that the original actress didn't want to do the nude scenes required for a character once she was back on Earth. Now, personally, I think, you know, come on, guys. The reason's far more obvious. It's a homage to Doctor Who itself, where the lead actor regularly regenerates into someone else. But Abducted by the Daleks isn't entirely bad. The scenes in the woods are surprisingly well shot and quite atmospheric, while the Dalek props, although clearly homemade, are, in their shonky way, quite impressive. Even if they are of varying heights and too thin, not to mention that in low shots you can see the casters underneath them, they roll along them. Overall, though, I can't help but feel that Abducted by the Daleks represents a missed opportunity in terms of creating Doctor Who-related erotica. If only it had been made in the 70s, I can't help but feel it would have made a fine sex comedy with Robin Asquith as the Doctor, perhaps, and a frequently naked Linda Hayden as his assistant. Doubtless there'd have been a scene where a Dalek casing popped open to reveal a naked woman inside. Bloody hell, missus! As Robin Asquith was prone to say. As I noted at the start, I'm only surprised that there haven't been more examples of Doctor Who porn. I'd like to believe that during the series' long hiatus in the 90s and early noughties, various former members of the production team spirited various props away from the BBC in order to produce sex films featuring dilapidated-looking cybermen and tatty sea devils threatening buxom young women with all manner of intergalactic sexual depravities. Perhaps they could have established a whole new genre of porn, exploring interspecies sexual relations with one lot of rubber-suited aliens copulating with another race of rubber-suited aliens. Ultimately, I suppose, the threat of legal action over copyright would have put them off. The BBC, after all, did eventually take action over Abducted by the Daleks, forcing a title change to Abducted by the Daloids. Although, interestingly, the title monsters remain in the films as quite clearly Daleks, and within the film are referred to as Daleks. But there you go.
Face the horror.
Ryan, listen to me! Get out of there now!
Cross the line and your nights will never be the same. Nights. Baywatch Nights.
What seems like an eternity ago, I started working my way through season 2 of Baywatch Nights, the season where the Baywatch Private Eye spin-off went completely bonkers and started featuring aliens, vampires and werewolves. Now, I covered my impressions of the first 4 episodes here last time out, and that's where the project stalled. Actually, it didn't stall completely. I did manage to watch the next 4 episodes, but I've never got around to either writing about them or covering them here. The problem was that none of these episodes was especially memorable, or featuring confusing, poorly developed plots and a paucity of budget that kept the action to a minimum. Nevertheless, as I'm determined to get back to wading my way through the series, I thought that I'd offer a brief overview of episodes 5 to 8. I mean, they get off to a poor start with Circle of Fear, a tale of witchcraft and black magic, which gets off to a good start with black masses and the like in the woods, but then settles into a pretty routine story involving ancient magical tomes and curses. Most of the action, such as it is, revolves around Ryan's apartment. She finds herself beset by all sorts of supernatural manifestations. The problem is that none of them are very interesting, and ultimately, nothing really happens. Oh, apart from the fact she has a problem with the plumbing. That's not a euphemism. Episode 6, The Cabin, at least has the distinction of being the balmiest episode yet. with Mitch and Ryan visiting a remote cabin in the woods and finding that it contains a number of portals through time and space, depositing them individually into dangerous situations in the past. They find themselves facing crazy killers and the like in the 19th century. Unfortunately, the episode lets itself down by concluding with one of those it-was-all-a-dream endings, the ultimate in cop-outs. The seventh episode, Case of the Mirrored Box, is a tale of voodoo, full of mildly racist stereotypes, which seems to have drawn most of its actual knowledge of voodoo from watching Live and Let Die. As with Circle of Fear, the story is less than gripping, poorly executed, and in places virtually incomprehensible. The final confrontation between Mitch and the local voodoo high priest is, to put it mildly, anticlimactic. Episode 8, Last Breath, is somewhat more intriguing, offering a crossover with regular Baywatch, as Mitch and Ryan investigate the disappearances of several lifeguards whilst they're carrying out rescues. The third of these involves Donna, the nightclub owner come lifeguard, and she's at last given something to do. It involves her being pulled out to sea by a float line before vanishing beneath the waves. Griff also makes a reappearance, helping Mitch out with some underwater investigation and getting shut in the boot of a submerged car for his troubles. The episode is notable for not having a supernatural resolution. It turns out all three missing lifeguards have been kidnapped by a guy whose brother and parents died when the car he was driving went into the sea. Lifeguards saved him, but not his family. He now wants to reenact the crash with the kidnapped lifeguard standing in for his family so that, this time, he can die with them and assuage the survivor's guilt. Despite the lack of a supernatural element, the episode is actually far more atmospherically shot than most of the supernatural episodes, with a real sense of unease pervading the proceedings. But overall, this is a weak run of episodes, which underline the fundamental problem afflicting Baywatch Nights, that its budget could never match its ambitions. With its lack of resources dictating that elaborate special effects were out of the series' reach, most of the supernatural goings-on can only manifest themselves obliquely. Consequently, its mainly derivative storylines could only ever end up as damp squibs. Even when it attempted something relatively original, The Cabin, that didn't require much in the way of special effects, it doesn't have the courage of its convictions and undermines it with that cop-out ending. Hopefully, going forward, things will improve, as this batch of episodes were, on the whole, too threadbare in terms of writing ideas and production values, even to raise the balminess to enjoyable levels.
Are you ready for the most dangerous women on Earth? They were called the Wonder Women, the most expert hit team this side of the underworld. Wonder Woman stars Nancy Kwan as the incredible and invincible Dr. Sue. She specializes in most unusual medical experiments.
It is possible for me to transplant any part of the human body.
Any part?
Any part.
Boss Hagen is Mike Harbour. He'll work for anyone, do anything, if the price is right. Mike is marked for death in everyone's book. Some because he asks too many questions, others because he knows too many answers. Wonder Woman is new action. Wonder Woman is new excitement, new adventure. Blasting the screen at a pulse-pounding pace that never lets up. The Wonder Woman. Beautiful, luscious, mysterious dolls. Trained by the sinister Dragon Lady to do as they were told. They were killers. A sisterhood of death. But they were also women. You never know what they'll come up with next. Maybe a kiss in the dark. Maybe a knife in the back. One man thought he could stop them, but they took him apart, piece by piece.
I first saw 1973's Wonder Woman decades ago, in either the late 70s or early 80s, when it's shown on late night TV, probably as part of one of BBC Two's horror double bill seasons on a Saturday night. To be honest, I remembered next to nothing about it, other than it was fuzzily shot yet low-budget effort, involving a lady mad scientist creating an army of superwomen via organ transplants. Significantly, it served as my introduction to the world of Philippine shot horror and horror and science fiction B-movies. They're a subgenre in themselves, often featuring the same, very recognisable, local character actors and support. Not to mention, even the locations become familiar, from the jungle interiors of the islands with isolated villages to the dog-eared glamour of big city Manila. Anyway, I re-watched Wonder Woman recently and was pleasantly surprised. It was actually nowhere near as bad as my vague recollections had led me to fear it would be, which isn't to say that it's some kind of lost minor classic. It still had all the hallmarks of a 70s Philippines shot programmer, the scuzzy-looking location photography, shaky production values, slightly tinny sound quality, and highly variable performances, for instance. Moreover, Vic Diaz and Sid Hay, with hair, without whom it often seemed no 70s Philippines exploitation movie would be complete, both play significant roles. It also featured the other essential characteristic of the genre, the B-grade American star whose career was on a downward trajectory. Now, for once, it wasn't John Ashley, rather Ross Hagen, who spent the better part of his career bouncing between various low-budget movie projects, mainly westerns and biker movies, and TV guest spots. Though Hagen wasn't the biggest name involved in Wonder Woman, starring as the villain was Nancy Kwan, who only a few years before had been co-starring with the likes of William Holden, Dick Van Dyke and Dean Martin. Hagen plays an international insurance investigator who, with his expensive taste and flamboyant wardrobe, comes on like a low-rent James Bond, toting a sawn-off shotgun instead of a Walther PPK. He's hired to look into the disappearance of a top athlete who, along with many others, has been kidnapped by Nancy Kwan's Dr. Sue to her island and cryogenically frozen until she can harvest their organs. A brilliant scientist as well as a supervillain, she's offering the world's wealthy the chance of rejuvenation using the stolen organs. She's also carrying out other experiments on the side, aimed at creating that race of super beings, which have resulted, on the one hand, in a cellar full of human-animal hybrid mutants, and on the other, her gang of super babes, the Wonder Women of the title, who carry out the abductions for her. Aside from this combination of ideas lifted from various other sources, loosely melted together into a ramshackle plot, Wonder Woman is notable for including a number of surprisingly well-staged action sequences. These range from the opening scenes of the Wonder Woman kidnapping various victims to a lengthy chase through the back streets involving Hagen, a pedal taxi, and various henchmen. Inevitably, the climax sees one of the Wonder Women falling for Hagen's shop-worn charms and changing sides. The mutants escaping from the cellar and a huge conflagration involving guards, Wonder Woman, and mutants slugging it out, where Hagen mows down numerous people with a machine gun. Director Robert Vincent O'Neill, who previously worked with low-budget legend David L. Hewitt and would later write and direct the first two Angel films, moves it all along at a frantic pace. And while it's on, Wonder Woman is hugely entertaining.
Once you fully understand, your life will have to wind down a very different road.
I want to know. How long ago did she die?
She has never really existed yet. You see, she's been assembled piece by piece, organ by organ. She's a composite, like Keith.
Keith.
Yes, you remember the so-called vampire killer.
You don't have to hurt me. She wasn't just murdered, if you know what I mean.
Tensile steel.
He didn't.
Eh?
Look.
A film I hadn't seen in an age, Scream and Scream Again from 1970, is notable as being the only one of two, I think, films to feature Vincent Price, Christopher Lee, and Peter Cushing. Indeed, this alignment of horror superstars was used as a selling point for the film. Unfortunately, it doesn't really deploy them particularly well. Cushing's role is, in truth, simply an extended cameo and has no interaction with the other two, while Lee gets a few more scenes and, right at the end, interacts with Price. He spends most of this time on the periphery of the film. Price has by far the most substantial role as a sinister scientist, but gives a curiously muted performance, leaving something of a vacuum at the centre of the plot. That said, Scream and Scream Again remains an effective and entertaining film, thanks to a typically discursive script from Christopher Wicking and some excellent, very dynamic direction from Gordon Hessler, and this is easily his best film. Featuring lots of tracking shots following various characters as they walk through scenes, Wicking's script intertwines three plot lines, which initially seem unconnected. The rise to power of a brutal and ruthless military officer in an unnamed Eastern European country, a jogger hospitalised after a collapse who keeps coming out of sedation to find another limb amputated, and a police investigation to a series of vampire murders in which young women are brutally killed and their blood drained. Slowly but surely, the three plots begin to come together, with all roads leading to the clinic of the mysterious Dr. Browning, played by Vincent Price. The conclusion explains just enough to satisfactorily wrap up the various plot strands, but leaves enough unexplained to maintain the air of disorientating mystery that pervades the film. The film is, in fact, derived from a 60s pulp novel, The Disorientated Man by Peter Saxon. And Peter Saxon, incidentally, was a house name used by a number of authors contributing to things like the Sexton Blake Library and the Guardian's horror paperback series. All of the plot elements and most of the incidents in Wicking's script are present in the novel, the difference lying in their presentation, with Wicking opting for a fragmented structure, not making obvious links between the subplots. The film presents everything as a series of incidents, playing down plot mechanics and inviting the viewer to try and piece everything together themselves. Hessler's direction takes its cue from Wicking's script structure, with the plots all presented in differing styles. The disappearing limb strand is presented as pure body horror, the stuff of the Eastern European dictatorship is a Cold War thriller, and the vampire killer strand is a police procedural, with the finale turning into balmy science fiction. The viewer has constantly bounced between the different plots and styles, constantly kept disorientated and intrigued. The strongest element is undoubtedly the police investigation, with its long tracking shots through the squad room, overlapping dialogue and extremely well-staged car chase. It also includes the film's two best performances, from Alfred Marx as Superintendent Belliver, delivering a real tour de force in the role, his presence is sorely missed when the character is killed off before the end, and Michael Gothard as Keith, the vampire killer, a creepy and seemingly unstoppable Superman, even pulls his own hand off to escape handcuffs. Also of note is Marshall Jones as Conrats, the East European officer, who effectively ties the three plots together, is the only character who interacts with Cushing, Lee and Price. Wicking's script is also notable for what it omits from the source novel. Well, the film eventually reveals that Browning's clinic is part of a global conspiracy to create a race of supermen and women from spare parts and place them in senior positions around the world. Jones, Lee and Price are all such constructs. while Keith was an early unstable creation. It never reveals exactly who originated the plot. The book, by contrast, reveals that the bodies are being created to provide receptacles for alien intelligences, as normal human bodies are apparently too frail to contain their energy. All as part of a plot to take over the planet by stealth. I actually own a second-hand copy of the novel, for what it's worth. According to some sources, this explanation was originally also a Wiking script, but was cut at some point. Whatever the truth, the more enigmatic conclusion of the finished film, with the superhuman plot still in place despite the elimination of Browning and Jones, judged by Lee to be aberrations, being too human and angst-ridden, too brutal and immoral, respectively, this ending actually feels both more appropriate and more satisfactory.
Who spurs the beast the corpse will ride? Who cries the cry that kills? When Satan questioned, who replied? Whence blows this wind that chills?
What if there is a power that we know nothing of?
He's on the house! A witch man!
She's bewitched!
A witch man!
Edgar Allan Poe probes new depths of terror. Vincent Price reaches new heights of horror.
H is for heretic.
I know nothing of witchcraft.
We can make you die a minute every day for a year.
I will kill as many of you as I need to.
I curse Lord Edward Whitman. I curse his flesh, his blood. I conjure you, Lord Satan, send me an avenger.
When Satan questions, who replies? Whence blows this wind that chills? What answers when the banshee cries? And kills, and kills, and kills.
Another Gordon Hessler Christopher Wiking collaboration for AIP, released the same year as Scream and Scream Again, 1970's Cry of the Banshee sadly doesn't come up to the standard of its predecessor. Compared to the earlier film, it's simply too conventional, both in theme and structure. Presenting its sub-witchfinder general tale of witch hunting as a straightforward narrative, with none of the cross-cutting between narrative threads and stylistic flair of Scream and Scream Again. The resemblance to Witchfinder General, even down to the casting of the film star Vincent Price in a similar role, is key here. Cry of the Banshee is entirely derivative, conceived by AIP in order to try and replicate the success of that film. The collaborator on Witchfinder General, Tygon, of course, made its own follow-up, The Blood on Satan's Claw, 1971, which, while not a commercial success, offered a fresh and original approach to its subject matter. Consequently, Cry of the Banshee has no impetus of its own. It exists purely to rehash the most popular tropes of the earlier film. Witch burnings, the persecution and torture of young women, and lots of bloody violence. Its only innovation is to add in an actual supernatural element which hadn't been present in Witchfinder General, which proves fatal to the narrative, not only removing any moral compass it might have had, but also depriving the audience of any truly sympathetic characters to identify with. Whereas in Witchfinder General, it's clear that there are no witches, only innocent victims of authority, the crimes attributed to the women persecuted by Matthew Hopkins merely being projected upon them by his own twisted psyche. In Cry of the Banshee, those being persecuted by Price's character really are witches who use their powers to wreak supernatural vengeance upon his whole family by unleashing the forces of evil. Ultimately, this leaves the viewer feeling that, while Price and his associates are brutal bastards who probably deserve everything they get, Una, played by Elizabeth Bergener, and a band of anachronistic hippies come witches, are equally culpable, sending Patrick Murrah in the form of a werewolf, well, at least that's what the makeup looks like, to indiscriminately tear out their throats. And to be absolutely fair to director Gordon Hessler, most of the film's problems predate his involvement. Although he brought in Christopher Wicking to rewrite Tim Kelly's original script, AIP executives limited the amount of changes that could be made. On top of this, AIP decided to re-edit the film before release, reordering the sequence of several scenes. The scene that opens this version of the film, Price's attack on the witch camp, originally came partway through the film, for instance. Moreover, Wilfred Joseph's score was replaced by a much more conventional score by Les Baxter, and Terry Gilliam's disturbing title animations replaced with stills under the titles. While the editing changes somewhat disrupt the film's narrative rhythm, the loss of the original score robs the movie of much of its period atmosphere. The interference seems ironic in light of the fact that AIP's executives had previously fought hard to resist attempts to interfere in Scream and Scream Again by co-producer Milton Subotsky of Amicus. Not surprisingly, Hessler considered Cry of the Banshee the least favourite of the four films he directed for AIP. But despite all of its problems, Cry of the Banshee does provide a lot of good unclean fun. The production values are just okay, but the various set pieces well staged, while Price, backed up by a number of familiar British TV faces, including Patrick Murray and Michael Elphick, gives a far more animated performance than they did in Scream and Scream Again. The original, unadulterated version of this film has been released on home video and sometimes turns up on TV. I recall seeing it screened on ITV back in the late 80s, early 90s, and is undoubtedly better than the original release version. Interesting though, recent screenings of the film by Talking Pictures TV have used the earlier cut, perhaps because it also removes all the bare breasts. Oh yes, before I forget, a lot of people have complained about the fact that no actual banshees feature in the film, despite the title. Nonetheless, references are made to the wailing disembodied voice of the legendary banshee by various characters, with the howling of what is first thought to be a wild dog, it's actually a hairy and lupine Patrick Moa, likened to the cry of the banshee. So pedants, the script does actually justify the title. Just.
This is an emergency. The unpleasant noise you hear on your radio receiver is not a mistake. Do not turn off your set, but turn up the volume as high as possible. This is an emergency.